Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Business Beyond Borders, where we have made it our mission to talk to global experts and professionals, entrepreneurs, CEOs, and founders from a variety of industries and fields as we tackle the many aspects of scaling an international business. The goal here is to collect valuable insights and share in-depth knowledge so that you too can apply the winning techniques and strategies to go global and take your business to the world.
Hi there, I'm Cynthia Dearen, and welcome to Business Beyond Borders, where I unlock the secrets of international business success. Today, I'm chatting to Jason Hood, founder of Berkhood, and his colleague, Eva Dobranska, who is head of operations. And we're going to be chatting about how research and development grants can help you as you expand your business overseas. Jason and Eva, welcome to the show. So tell me, what is Berkhood exactly, and how did you guys get started?
Yeah, so Berkhood is essentially my mother's maiden name and my last name. I'm Jason Hood, the founder and CEO. And essentially where we came into it was I was living in London for about 3 years and fell into the largest R&D specialist in Europe, a company called Leighton. They help companies get back research, development, tax incentives and R&D grants. They're in 21 countries worldwide. I ended up going very, very well for them in the sales people at about 300 people. And thought, I'm Sydney, I'm coming back to Australia, and created Berkhood. So, yeah, again, my mother's maiden name, our last name, and we're on a mission to essentially help all companies, but majority startups, essentially claim back the R&D incentives. And at the moment, across Sydney, New Zealand, the US and UK, that's where we've branched off over the last year.
Yeah, so I found myself working with Jason for almost 2 years now. And starting, you know, really small, now we've grown to cover 4 geographies. We've got hundreds of clients. We help them secure millions in R&D benefits. So it's been very exciting to see that growth and what we were able to enable other startups and companies do as well. So essentially, that is the vision behind it.
We're trying to make expand to Poland so our young Polish lass can go over there.
And you were just mentioning creating an impact even in the last couple of years. I mean, COVID-19 has been a pretty big thing on everybody's radar and something that's had a massive impact on the world as a whole. But what have you seen in terms of impact of COVID-19 in the R&D space over the last year and a bit? What does it look like?
I think what I would say, what we were talking about and what we've seen is that it's oftentimes that in the times of crises, this is where many new startups are being formed and so on, like Airbnb, TransferWise, they all started during the financial crisis. And I think something similar that we could be seeing in the R&D space is that if anything, COVID has stimulated even more innovation going around, especially in the medical space, the med tech space, wellness, health and fitness as well. So what I can tell from the clients that we're working with is that there is much more innovation going on in light of, you know, the external stimuli that are forcing us to innovate, which is really good to see. And so this really highlights the need for the R&D tax incentive schemes. And it really shows how governments can actually encourage more innovation going into it. So I think, if anything, I would say that the impact was brutal but positive when it comes to innovation.
In saying that too, contradict Eva here as well, is there's been a lot of companies that are going under, obviously, because of COVID. So it's all right us putting rosy-coloured glasses on saying that because of COVID, there's R&D there. But the short of it is that a lot of companies haven't got the money to invest in R&D because they're not getting the revenues in there or essentially they've had to go under. And again, sorry for sort of contradicting that. She's right in saying that there has been opportunity for research and development. On a lighter note, is the governments have been a lot more rewarding or essentially giving a lot of more money out because in the past, for example, the Australian government, they had a $3 billion R&D tax fund, but then they gave a $70 billion stimulus package away for different variables or different causes. So I think all in all, a lot of governments have been a bit more supportive or they've created more funds to get the economy going, especially this is a pure example for the research and development being conducted.
A bit of a mixed picture then.
Yeah, like you're saying, with the companies going under. So I think both positive and negative effects, it will be hard to say that it's just been one of them. But yeah, that's why essentially we're here. We're just trying to like find a way through it, help as many people as we can.
let's talk about R&D tax incentives. A lot of people listening to this show will be curious but won't really understand exactly what they are. So can you tell us how do R&D tax incentives work and who can access them?
Yeah, good question. And to be honest with you, there'll be a lot of people out there that think they do know about it as well, and they've been claiming it for years and whatever that may be. So the reason why we also love helping people that have already been claiming it for so many years is because you don't know what you don't know. So someone's got their accountant or themselves that have been successful in claiming the R&D tax credits. I'll go into what it is in a minute. But what we like to say is they're not specialists or they don't know exactly what they can claim, what they can't, and keep up with legislation. So an accountant may know that 20% is R&D, 20% isn't R&D, but they don't know how to justify or clarify that 60% in the middle, that gray area, because they don't know the difference between their science, their engineering, or their software portfolio of clients, so to speak. To go on to your question, is in Australia, you get back 43 cents to the dollar if you're in a loss for research and development. Most people think it's either curing cancer or next Silicon Valley lab rat. However, we've got clients across all sectors, ranging from aerospace engineering to dentists to pharmacists, whatever that may be. And again, it's great to know from an overall country perspective, because I know you mentioned and sort of your bread and butter is the transition into other geographies or the global expansion. So it's good depending on where your parent company is going to be or have an understanding of where you're going to do your tech of what incentive is beneficial to your company itself. Because a lot of them all have different legislation, different changes of software development team. If you spend an X amount offshore, you can claim or you can't claim, depending on the geography. So it's good to get that all back as well.
Yeah, yeah. And I think this has been one of the challenges mentioned by some of the people that we were talking to, where they chose to have their development team offshore and then they only found out about the tax credits from us. And they would say, oh, I wish I knew about it earlier because I would have employed someone locally in order so that I can claim back on them. It's always good to, you know, educate yourself on the different R&D schemes that are offered by many countries. So to know whether that would be behind your decision of internationalization or whether that would be behind your decision to, you know, conduct your development work in that specific country. Like Jason mentioned earlier, in Australia, it is 43 cents to the dollar, in New Zealand, 15%, and there's different rates and different eligibility criteria, basically, depending on geographies.
And so what are people actually claiming for? What falls into that basket of R&D? Because, you know, innovation covers a pretty wide spectrum of stuff. Is it just for tech companies, or can people who are providing services and demonstrate that they're doing something innovatively and that they've had to conduct research in order to do that, can they claim it? Who's usually able to claim and what for?
Yeah, good question. I suppose the plug there is it's very, very, very broad, as you rightly pointed out, Cynthia. And everyone's heard of most people have heard of the Airtask episode, or people receiving the money and then paying back tens of millions, whatever that may be. And a lot of the time as well, it's because you either haven't demonstrated it perfectly. There's R&D across a lot of sectors, from engineering to science. We've got food manufacturers. We've had microwavable fish fingers that never eventuated or like a perfect. And rather than the outcome, you have to have obviously the intent to commercialize, which 99% of the time most companies will, unless it's like a internal HR portal or something like that. But they have the intent to commercialize, but it's not so much the outcome as such that a lot of companies do focus on. It's the actual journey of getting there. So it's actually that technical justification and technical uncertainties and then roadblocks and hiccups, so to speak, of the journey getting there. So that's where a lot of people do miss out on that. To go back to your question, again, sort of how long's a piece of string? We've got pharmacists, we've got dentists, we've got agriculture, there's just science ones, name a few. Aerospace engineering, civil engineering, AI, machine learning, software development, the obvious ones. But yeah, again, it's more about the justification behind that and the actual challenges that you're facing throughout the development or the project itself.
So what do you think the weirdest or the most unusual R&D grant application you've ever seen is?
Probably should keep it PG and then go into a different sector. But yeah, rather than a specific sector, it'd probably be around sort of food manufacturing, where a client of ours, they were actually doing food manufacturing where they're trying to minimize the bubbles in the cake. And obviously that was just to make the size smaller of that. But yeah, all that time and effort and all the production and the cost of going to that cake, that was where the R&D, just to minimize bubbles in a cake, air bubbles, that is. So, yeah, I mean, there's been a few more, especially across my time in London as well. But, yeah, that's sort of a weirdish one, I suppose.
I like that cake example, though, because I think, you know, when I think R&D grant, I usually think, yeah, it pretty much has to be for space technology or something very, very high tech. And you might, so I, in my mind, there are probably opportunities there that people are not capitalizing on because they assume that the sector that they work in is not tech enough or not scientific enough or not cutting edge enough for them to be able to get that grant.
And you're spot on, Cynthia. And I suppose the way sort of we help companies as well is, and again, I'm not trying to plug ourselves into that because it's more informative, but it's people using it as a financial analysis tool as well, that if they did know about the incentive, they might hire that extra engineer, that extra scientist, or that extra software developer, which one, helps them either make their product more advanced, or two, allows the economy to get going even more because they're paying another staff member a salary. So that's what it's there for. The government do want you doing R&D. They do want you employing more people and having a more innovative product, which then naturally should lead to a greater product, greater business, therefore greater revenues, therefore paying taxes later on. So it all comes around that feedback loop.
Yeah, and building on that, I think what's important here to know is to be aware of what can be claimed, and that is around the cost. So mostly the biggest proportion of the cost that we are claiming from the claims would be the salaries and wages, as well as subcontractors, but then also a portion of utilities, consumables, and software licenses costs that are utilized in the R&D activity. So like you mentioned earlier on, someone might be in a sector that they would think that it's not really R&D, but then maybe they will engage with a subcontractor that is a developer's team, and that developer's team comes on board with them for a couple of months. There could be scope for claiming there. So I think that's important to know what cost categories can be claimed.
So for example, if I had a client that was in, for example, affiliate marketing, and they brought on a development team to develop a new piece of their product and a new part of their platform, is that something that could get claimed back under R&D?
Yeah, very good question. Is exactly right. So we've got digital marketing companies, whatever that may be, who as such aren't doing R&D, and you've got to tread carefully there, because digital marketing company and marketing teams, rule of thumb, affiliate marketing, there's no R&D there. But if they're essentially creating a new AI machine learning data set or analysis to then plug in or create their own API, so to speak, to enhance the affiliate marketing, that's where the R&D component is. So, yeah, you're 100% right there, Cynthia.
Cool. Let's talk a little bit about how R&D schemes work in the context of international expansion. I mean, how does it... Tell us a bit about how it plays into that international journey. How can a founder who is looking at international expansion really get benefit from R&D grants?
Yeah, so again, it sort of crosses over, and we're all Australian, or we're an Australian country here, but it sort of works out where your parent company wants to be as well, because therefore some companies, being in the UK or other areas, and how big your development is or your prototype or your R&D is going to be as well, because different incentives across different globes or different countries, I should say, benefit each client. So here in Australia, you have other grants such as EMDG grant, which is Export Development Market grant, as you would know about. But therefore, if you forfeit the R&D claim here and create a parent company somewhere else, you wouldn't get that because you're doing the R&D or your parent company somewhere else. So depends on where your development's going to be, depends on the incentive itself. So the geographies we cover, probably UK is your best one. You go back 2 years, you get back 33% below the line, which means it's not on your profit and loss accounts. Australia is 43.5% cash going back 1 year. New Zealand, 15%, as I mentioned, so probably a little bit lower. And then America is 10%, but as a rule of thumb, but you don't get back the cash. So again, just depends on sort of what the goals are first, rather than go to this country, do that. But again, it's money that you're entitled to, but a lot of people leave on the table or don't maximize. And then and I'm sounding like a broken record here, so I apologize, but they do like a raise, they go to do a raise first and they dilute themselves or whatever that may be, rather than go and use this R&D component or even the R&D lending scheme where you can actually lend against your R&D 3, 6, or 9 months throughout the year. They want to go out and raise capital, whether it because they want to tell everyone they've raised or whether because they need to. They then dilute themselves later on, which therefore if they raise again later on or sell their company, they've got less of an ownership. So we always say there's a good reason why you should use up the R&D as much as possible and optimize that, because it gives you more runway to then raise a higher valuation or depending on what the goals are for the company.
Yeah. And is there a cap on the amount that you can spend on R&D and get back?
20 million in Australia is the cap between the small company scheme, SME scheme, and the large company scheme. I won't go into the large company too much, but it's an offset rather than cash back. New Zealand, no cap. And then the UK, by memory, is 80 million euros turnover. So it's quite a bit more, and then the US, no cap either.
Just thinking about how this works again in an international context, I'm assuming that if you are claiming your R&D grant in a particular jurisdiction, you have to actually do the R&D in that jurisdiction. So, you know, if I claim it in the UK, I have to do the R&D in the UK. I can't go and get a team in Estonia to do the R&D and still claim it in the UK. Is that right?
The assumption you're making should be right. And in Australia, you're 100% right. There is a bit of leniency in Australia. I'll focus on Australia first. You can get the approval for overseas findings in advance. In New Zealand, you can claim 10% of what you claim as R&D offshore. And in the UK, they only changed it last April, believe it or not, but you could claim up to 65% of all your R&D spend, whether it be Estonia, as you mentioned, or India. But now in the UK, it's only 3 times maximum what you spend in the UK. So if, for example, I employ us three that are software developers in the UK for £100,000 and I have a development team in India spending £2 million, we can only claim 3 times the value of what we're paying on the UK staff. So, yeah, they've changed that around, but that's probably a good example there of being in the UK. If you want to have an offshore development team, you're spending on a lot. That means you can claim the R&D over there, whereas Australia, you couldn't claim anything offshore.
What kind of things do you think companies should be doing as they're thinking about this to make sure that they're actually eligible to get an R&D grant, even if it's just going to be in the future? You know, if they don't need it now, but they think in 12 months' time, 2 years' time, we're going to want to claim for one, what do you need to do to make sure you don't strike out? Or what could you do that would make sure that you didn't get it?
Yeah, do you want me to answer this? Or do you want to go?
I think what comes to mind straight away is good record keeping. So obviously for the purposes of your R&D application, you're going to need to describe your technical project, including the milestones, the roadmap that you followed, any pivots to strategy, any failed attempts at it, any changes to your approach. If you've got your notes, like meeting notes, project milestones and roadmaps, any plans, any PowerPoint presentations, the more of that record keeping you have and you keep track of it on a yearly basis, the easier it will be later on for you to build the R&D claim, because the application will ask you what was the objective of your development activity, what was the technical uncertainty you faced, how did you overcome this uncertainty, and what did your team do in order to find a solution, develop the solution, how did the systematic process look like? So these are all of the items that you're going to need to go over, and the more information you've got at hand, the easier it will be for you to show it in the application. That is the technical side of it, which is half of your application. The other half is the financials. And that's just your standard bookkeeping to make sure you keep track of all of the costs, all of the hours that your employees are spending on their work, because then all of those hours will be apportioned as R&D in the application.
Is there anything you can do to strike out? I mean, what kind of things would disqualify you from getting an R&D grant? Is there anything in particular?
Trying to do it again, trying to probably do it yourself. And a lot, what we find often is a lot of companies, whether that be accountants doing it for them or experts in the field themselves. So, like, for example, an AI machine learning software developer, in software development, they're the cream of the top. And when they get asked to do the R&D claim or fill it all out, it's taken away from first their own business operations or what they're good at, but they don't know what's R&D or what's run of the mill or what they've been in university for. So a lot of them will start writing it in a technical nature that's too technical a lot of the time, that they don't almost the respective governing body, whether that be the ATO, Inland Revenues or HMRC, don't really want to understand that you've used Python, Java, integrated with blah, 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 whatever that may be. They just want to see it from a technical standpoint of where the R&D lies from their legislation and their point of view. So I think a lot of the time people try and get a bit too creative, that don't understand what the R&D is from an actual black and white ATO standpoint or whatever that is. And then therefore they hand it over to their software developer and they don't know where to start. So I think it's just combining the industry knowledge and sector knowledge to then give a justified and portrayed argument of what's R&D. But yeah, besides that, nothing really off the top of my head.
Really about writing the grant the right way and making sure that you put in an application that is actually going to match what the people assessing it are going to look for.
Exactly. And yeah. I think one that comes to mind is a lot of people focus, I touched on this earlier, is a lot of people focus on their biggest project or the project that's brought in the most income, whereas what we say is your hiccups or your failed projects are the best ones there are. So rather than focus on the one that you spent the most R&D on, and again, cliche word that I just mentioned, but it's the challenges, it's the failed projects what they want to see rather than, yes, they want the intent to commercialize, but they want to see that technical uncertainty, technical challenges that highlights the scheme the most.
And when a company is looking at different international markets and they're trying to make a decision about which international market they should go into next, how much weight do you think they should give to R&D incentive schemes when they're making that decision? I mean, is it at the top of the list in your view of things that you look for? Is it somewhere in the middle? Is it down the bottom? Is it, you know, how much weight do you think people should give it when they're making that decision?
Yeah, I'll answer this. Look, you can have a billion-dollar idea having an e-commerce platform. So there's not too much R&D around that, provided you've got the good product, provided you've got the marketing to go for that. Obviously, you need cash to benefit from the R&D incentive. So obviously, you might have to set up a company in Delaware to have access to a VC fund or whatever it may be because they're in America. So first, you need cash for the door, or you need a product that essentially you can build on, or if you have the cash there. In saying that, again, I could sit here and sort of lie and go, oh, it's one thing you need to matter about, it's one thing you need to do. But again, depend on what the goals are of the company or what the ambition is moving forward, then obviously you can take that into account. If it's because you've got $2 million and you want to get back X amount for R&D incentives, then it should be a massive, massive priority. But if it's something where you've got a company that works, you're in cash flow positive position and it's just a bonus, then it may be less of a priority. So I think it's just case by case, depending on what the company's needs and their objectives moving forward.
Yeah, and building on what you mentioned earlier about capital raising, I think it should be always considered in conjunction with, you know, looking for potential investors, because access to the R&D money, sometimes that is this very much needed cash injection to manage your cash flows and move on further with your projects. And that can also act as a proof point to potential investors. And that money is non-dilutive. That money stays with you. It does not take away your equity. So when it comes to, you know, deciding for the international expansion, as you mentioned, I think the R&D tax credits should be considered alongside whether you're planning to raise in that country that you're aiming to expand to, and also where your development work could be. Like, is the development team that you want to work with, are they based in the States or are they based somewhere else? So like Jason said, exactly, case by case basis. But I think it's always important to know that the R&D tax credits are connected to quite many different things. So it's very strategic of how you can use them to your advantage.
Guys, it has been awesome having you on the show today. Thank you for coming in and for talking about an area that a lot of people are probably a little bit intimidated by because it feels very technical. Thanks for coming in and kind of simplifying that for us and giving people some ideas and pointers as to where they should go. Where should people go if they want to find you and they would like to ask you questions? What's the best way to get in touch?
So best one would be to just send us an email to our team, which we've got. We've got our generic email, info@borghood.com. And then we're also always reachable via LinkedIn. So on our page, Borghood, that's where we make sure to post all of the updates, any legislative changes. Our team is all across it. So if you want to give us a follow, reach out to our team, then we're always there to chat.
And have you got any final thoughts for business owners who are thinking about scaling internationally?
Yeah, I heard a good one yesterday that I implemented with the guys today. And whether this be right or wrong is, I think a lot of people are placing a greater emphasis now on raising the capital, or they're trying to use so many resources in doing so. And someone told me the other day, again, whether this be right or wrong, there's two components to a business. There's sales and there's sales support. So a lot of people now are trying to raise so much money, they're forgetting what does work, and a company doesn't go forward unless they've got sales. So rather than exhausting so much time in raising capital or whatever that may be, especially in this current climate, I think just focus on the sales and focus on what you're good at, to then use that for the expansion moving forward, is a great bit of advice that I learned from somebody the other day, actually. So yeah, sales, one side of the business, or there's sales support, which includes everything else.
Yeah, and I think with the R&D tax incentive, because they're claimed retrospectively, so you first need to spend the money in order to get it back, is just to remember that as long as you ensure eligibility, the more you spend, the more of it you can get back, and that funding is non-dilutive. You get it back as cash if you're in a loss here in Australia, and you can move the project forward, which was great to see in so many different cases of our clients who are able to hire new staff, buy new machinery, expand more of their operations, and just grow their businesses.
That is a fantastic point. It's a pleasure to talk to you guys, and I look forward to seeing where you guys take Borghood next.
Thanks, Cynthia. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Hi, everyone. This is Maher again, and just a few things before you head off. Firstly, if you feel you have gained valuable insights from the show, make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss another episode. More importantly, don't forget to tell your fellow entrepreneur and business leader friends that this is the best podcast to tune into if they're looking to take on the world with their products and services. Also, if you are loving the podcast, please take the time to rate and review, as it's one of the best ways for us to get loads of free value into the hands of other entrepreneurs. And lastly, make sure to visit DearinAssociates.com. That's D-E-A-R-I-N, associates.com. where we have plenty of free resources and tools for you to get clarity and build momentum with your international venture. If you go there, you'll find the blueprint to international success, ebooks, our latest blog posts, and more. So be sure to check it out. And until next time, this is me encouraging you to expand your vision and wishing you all the best as you continue your global journey.